If I could have your attention, please. My name is Horace McMullen. I am the director of the Day Spring program at Westminster College, and it is my distinctive privilege to welcome you here to the second plenary session of our 1981 Sunstone Theological Symposium. Before we continue further, I will call upon Leonard Arrington to lead us in prayer.
Our Heavenly Father, we are grateful for this opportunity of meeting together this evening. We are grateful for our distinguished lecturer. We are grateful for the sponsors of this occasion. We pray thy blessings upon us this evening, that we may be receptive to what our distinguished speaker will convey to us. We pray also for thy spirit to be with us this evening throughout this symposium and at all times. We pray thy blessings upon all of thy children throughout the world. We pray, Heavenly Father, that we may merit the blessings which we receive from thee. We do this in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
I would like to say a word or two about the Day Spring program, because it may not be familiar to many, if perhaps not to most of you. It was started 3.5 years ago at Westminster College in order to provide opportunities for continuing education for clergy and laity in this area, because for Protestant and Catholic clergy and laity, there is no graduate seminary closer than Denver on the east or San Francisco on the west. The word dayspring is found in the King James Version of the Bible in two places. One from the words of Zechariah in connection with the nativity story in St. Luke, and also in the book of Job. The word is a poetic term for dawn, and was chosen by the group, the committee that set up Dayspring, because it seemed to suggest the setting of our history, that as Christians and believers, we are convinced that midnight is past, but high noon is still before us, and that dawn has come in the coming of Jesus Christ. We live, therefore, in a time of hope and in confident anticipation of the fulfillment of God's purposes in history in the eschaton. We are, therefore, the dawn people. This is some of the thinking behind the choice of the term dayspring. We are very glad to be invited by Peggy Fletcher, for whom we were waiting for a while. I think she's been out gallivanting with Kenneth Woodward, and I don't know where she is even now. But, oh, she is down here. Well, we're glad they arrived, because our regular introducer could not come because of illness. It is my pleasure in a moment to introduce our introducer, and I'm glad that we have one. Last March, Dayspring sponsored a Utah interfaith consultation, of which some of you may have heard, which was attended by about 100 persons, approximately half LDS, half non-LDS. They spent 2 days on the campus of Westminster College considering very bluntly, very openly, theological, psychological, and social differences. The issues that tend to separate us. This consultation was undertaken not with the assumption that we would find some nice common ground on which we could all unite, but that we are all human, And we need mutual understanding. We need acceptance from one another. And we need also to learn from one another. It was a very exciting occasion, and for me it provides the background for our participation in this kind of joint occasion that I find equally exciting. Dayspring's participation in this symposium is very minor. I cannot help being reminded of the old chestnut of the story of the man who was in a restaurant and chose from the menu rabbit pie. It didn't taste to him entirely like rabbit, so he questioned the waitress and evoked from her finally an admission that there was also horse meat in it. And he asked her how much, and she said, well, it's 50-50, one horse and one rabbit. We have been very much the rabbit in this occasion, taking a very minor role. And I must pay tribute to Peggy Fletcher's diligence, vision, and commitment to this symposium this year, which is on a still grander scale and a more ecumenical scale than the ones of the last 2 years. It has been a delight to work with her, doing some planning, but playing a very minor role, and it is my real privilege to be here on the podium this evening. I was gently informed by Peggy that my introduction of the introducer could be briefer than the introducer's introduction of the speaker. And so it is my pleasure to present, without ado, Kenneth Woodward, who will be our main speaker tomorrow evening, but tonight is going to introduce a, I believe, personal friend and acquaintance, Dr. Peter Berger. Mr. Woodward.
This is my third visit to Salt Lake City and environs, and one thing I've learned is gallivanting is not tolerated in Utah. I'm just trying to preserve Peggy's reputation, that's all. It is a privilege to introduce Peter Berger, and I wasn't expecting to do this. I asked to do it because I never know where he came from, so I have a little cheat sheet that tells me his whole background. So now I know, and I will be very brief indeed. Peter was born in Vienna, Austria, took his Ph.D. from the New School of Social Research in New York City. He is currently a professor at Boston College. I know him better by his books. I have, I think, all but one of them in my my home library. And I'm sure you've heard of the Sacred Canopy, the Room of Angels, which would be most applicable to this kind of audience, and also the Heretical Imperative. There's a book that he did with Thomas Luckman called The Social Construction of Reality, a treatise in the sociology of knowledge. And I must confess, I read this about every 3 years. I find it very useful as a journalist for the kind of thing that I try to do and what I try to understand, which is how people very different from me think and feel about matters of ultimate concern and immediate responsibility. As a journalist, my admiration for Peter is special in that he writes well. Not many academics do. Peter is always a delight to read. There's always a great deal of wit. There's always a great deal of insight. And I always find things that I can argue with when I read his works. And I hope and I'm sure tonight you'll find plenty to argue with after you listen to him. Thank you very much. Peter Berger.
thank you very much for a very generous introduction. One of the first rules of public speaking is that one should never begin with an apology, but I think I have to break this rule this evening because I realize that as the next 45 minutes or so proceed, I will increasingly sound like a water buffalo laboriously trying to breathe. I assure you this is not the fault of Utah, but still the air on the East Coast, which gives me hay fever, and I am not yet recovered from it, so I hope I will be more or less at least comprehensible. Since I broke the first rule of public speaking, which is never to apologize, I should at least adhere to the second one, which is to always begin with a joke, and I will do that, and you can meditate on that joke while I talk about other things that may not interest you, and perhaps by the time I'm finished with my remarks, you may understand the joke. It is not irrelevant to what I will talk about. This is a Southern Baptist joke. I don't know much about Utah. I don't know if there are Southern Baptists up here. But in any case, it's a Southern Baptist joke about a preacher who was preaching on the text from the Bible where Jesus says that in hell there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And this preacher got sort of carried away by that text and kept repeating it. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And finally, there was a sort of smart alecky young man sitting on the first row, got tired of this, and he interrupted the preacher and said, "Hey, preacher, what about those that have no teeth?" And the preacher only stopped for a fraction of a second and leaned over and said, "Brother, teeth will be supplied." Now, the title of my presentation was, I think, deliberately kept broad by the organizers of this conference for whatever reasons. Actually, I want to talk about a slightly more focused topic than was indicated in the program. I would like to talk about something that has very much preoccupied me for many years now, and that seems peculiarly relevant to what you are doing at this conference right now, namely the problem of pluralism and its relationship to religion, especially in the United States, though it is also very relevant, in fact increasingly relevant, in other parts of the world. Now, when I say pluralism, so what I really want to talk about is contemporary possibilities of religion and of faith in an age of pluralism. What I mean by pluralism is nothing at all esoteric or technical. It is something very simple. I'm using the word in a very ordinary way, namely that we live in a society, especially in the United States, in which there is a great variety of different worldviews, religious and other, existing side by side. The reasons for this historically are well known. This country do not need elaboration. What interests me has interested me for quite a while, and it still preoccupies me in different ways, is what this means for the religious faith of individuals and also for religious institutions. Now, when most people talk about, whether they are sociologists or theologians or historians or what have you, talk about the problems of religion in the modern world, they are very likely to talk about secularity or secularization. Again, a term about which lots of books have been written, but which essentially refers to something quite simple, namely that in the modern world, for whatever reasons, and scholars disagree on those reasons, religious symbols and religious institutions seem to have lost some of their earlier importance. Religious institutions do not any longer play the central public role, at least that they used to play. Separation of church and state politically is a typical example of this institutional change. But also in the consciousness of very large numbers of people in the modern world, religious belief, religious symbols seem to be less important than used to be the case. Now, some of you who are in field of religion as scholars know that in recent years there's been quite a lot of debate over the concept of secularity, over what some scholars have called the secularization thesis, namely the notion that this kind of secularity has been growing in the modern world. And I don't really want to go into this. I want to simply reaffirm my own position that yes, there has been such a thing as secularization. I think there are the reasons for it are not mysterious. They have to do with very visible structures of the modern world. But the point I want to make is this, that in my opinion, pluralism, as I have just defined it, is at least as important as secularization in producing a very important challenge to religion, and I think increasingly not only to religion but also to morality in our society. And I'd like to spin this out for you a little bit, particularly on the moral part of it, because that is something I have not yet written about and that increasingly preoccupies me. I suppose when you have written as many books as Ken Woodward showed me up as having written, you always hope that in the audience there are many people who haven't read the thing that you have written, because they will then everything you say will be new, and of course one can't have nothing but new ideas. So those of you who have read some of my books will recognize some of the things I say. I will say some other things too. Well, I would like to, when we talk about pluralism, I think we should make a distinction between one aspect of it, which is very obvious, namely the institutional aspect, and the other aspect, which is, I think, much less obvious, but ultimately more important, and that is that aspect of pluralism which has to do with the consciousness and minds of individuals. At any rate, in America, the pluralism of institutions, at least religious institutions, I think we can say has been fairly successfully handled by this society. There are continuing institutional problems of one sort or another, especially in questions that have to do with the relationship of church and state. Just where are the boundaries to be drawn? I think we're going to have a big... we have a number of issues now on the political agenda where this will be, again, this question of boundaries will erupt probably quite powerful in the political arena. One, of course, is the issue of prayer in public schools, which has been haunting a lot of Americans since the Supreme Court decision of, what was it, 1954, I believe, which prohibited it. Another issue, which I personally find much more interesting, which I think is also going to create a big public problem, is the problem of tax credits for education, because it will raise the whole question of public funds going to religious schools. So there are problems of the boundaries of church and state, and there are some other problems in the relationships of religious institutions in this society. But if you look at human history as a whole, I think it is remarkable that in this country, for quite a while now, perhaps not quite from the beginning of the Republic, but not much later, a very large number of highly diverse religious groups have coexisted with each other in a state of civic peace. And that is both historically unusual and, I suppose, something that Americans can be very satisfied about. Okay, the institutional problem of religious pluralism then has been, I think, quite successfully handled by this society. But the aspects of religious pluralism that concern the consciousness and minds of individuals are, I think, still not very well understood. And it is my thesis, has been my thesis for a while, that if we understand what pluralism does within the consciousness of individuals, we come, I think, rather quickly to one of the core problems of modernity in general, not just religion in modernity. A couple of years ago, I published a book under the title The Heretical Imperative, in which I spun this idea out at enormous length. Let me spin it out at lesser length this evening, because I think it's important for the other things I will have to say. Modernity, modernization, can be defined in different ways, and since it's a very complex phenomenon, there's not one single correct definition. There are different definitions which lead one to see different aspects of the phenomenon. But I think one definition of modernity, which, while it is an oversimplification, is, I think, a very valid one, is to describe modernity as a movement of human beings from fate to choice, from destiny to decisions, both in terms of their actions, the actions of people, and in terms of the consciousness of people. Let me explain what I mean by this. It is certainly, I think, in a very obvious way, and many of you have had personal experience in third world countries, particularly in areas of the third world in which modernization is either just beginning or in some areas hasn't even really begun yet. You will, I think, understand from your own experience what I'm talking about. There are some very obvious aspects of this change from fate to choice, even in the material level. In a pre-modern society, the number of material artifacts that people have for their use are very limited. In order to perform a certain task, one employs certain tools. Well, in our society, we have fully developed modern society, we have an incredible number of tools at our disposal. And in a capitalist society, such as American society, in which large numbers of products compete with each other on the market, we are bombarded with advertisement which tells us that this particular gadget is better than that gadget, this machine better than that machine, and so forth. So there is an enormous range, an enormous expansion of choice. Am I going to use this machine or that machine? Am I going to use this process or that process? Now, this is, I think, this technological aspect of the movement from fate to choice is very, very important, because technology is what really is the underlying engine of modernity that keeps the whole thing moving. But it is much more important to see that on this basis of technology, there is also an enormous expansion. In fact, one could call it an explosion of choices that have to do with every other area of human life. Among critics of modern Western society, leftist critics or people generally antagonistic to our kind of society, there's often the, and I get this from students quite frequently when I say what I've just said here, you get the notion, well, these aren't real choices, that all these choices we have really are only seeming choices. Well, I think that's a very hard position to defend once you look at facts. And you can take certain basic things that happen in the life of an individual and say, in our society, almost everyone, not only rich people, but this is even true of very poor people, have the following choices. They have the choice to live somewhere else from where their parents live. They have the choice of taking an occupation other than that of their fathers or mothers. The mothers also work. They have the choice as to whom they should marry or whether they should marry at all. They have a choice of what kind of school they should send their children to. Large number of choices of this sort, which through most of human history were no choices at all, but were absolutely fixed by tradition, by the institutions within which an individual in a pre-modern society existed. Now, what does this have to do with religion? Well, it has to do with religion, first of all, in the most direct way, that just as we can make all these other choices in our lives, we can also make the choice as to what religious affiliation we are going to have. And it's a choice which is, first of all, based in law. I mean, no one in the United States can be forced to belong to a certain religious group. No one can be prevented from leaving a religious group. No one can be forced to attend religious services. All of these are terribly basic things. But it's much more than law. It is something that has to do with the whole social dynamics of American society. And in this, as in so many other things, language reflects very well what the social situation is. I think there's one American phrase that more than any other expresses the underlying reality of pluralism, religious pluralism in America, and that is the phrase religious preference. It hit me very much. I came to America as a very young man from Europe, and a few months after I came to America, I was 18 years old, I registered for college. And in the college application form, it was a Protestant college I went to, one of the questions was, what is your religious preference? And although my English was fairly good at that point, I didn't understand the phrase, religious preference. It's a peculiarly American phrase. Now, what does the word, of course, what they meant was, what is your denomination? Okay? The word is a very interesting word, because, of course, it's a word that comes from consumer language. I prefer this product as against that product. Now, what does the word preference mean? I think it means two things. First of all, it means that I have a choice. Okay? If I prefer this over that, it means I could choose the other as against the one which I have. Very basic. It also suggests, I think, that the choice is perhaps not a desperate one. It is a choice that one might make without necessarily wrenching one's life apart. Now, please, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that for most Americans, the choice between one religious affiliation and another is comparable, is on the same low level of importance as the choice between consumer products. I'm not saying that. But nevertheless, it does suggest that one could make this move without destroying one's social existence, which would certainly have been the case and still is the case in many parts of the world where religious pluralism of this sort does not exist. Only the other day I saw actually an old friend of mine that I haven't seen in many years who crossed my path again, a man from Pakistan who was a convert from Islam to Christianity and whose life has been totally changed by that fact. One aspect of the change being that his family refused to have any dealings with him from that point on of any sort. I mean, he was as if he were dead. For them. Now, for someone who goes through this kind of religious change, the term religious preference somehow would not be appropriate. But for a Presbyterian who moves across town and finds that the Episcopal Church, for whatever reason, is more congenial to him and his family than the Presbyterian Church, and therefore he joins the Episcopal Church, that is a very different kind of biographical step. There are other American expressions that I think are very interesting in this connection. I happen to be is a very nice one. I happen to be Catholic. Very interesting. What does that mean? I could be something else. You know, I happen to be a Catholic. A more recent addition to this vocabulary, I guess like so many innovations of our language, this one comes from California. I'm into Buddhism, which means that next year I might be out of it again. All right? Same implication of transience. And then one I find absolutely fascinating, which I get very often from students. I'm trying to find out what my faith is. Okay? I vividly remember when I first heard this phrase. I'm free associating here this evening, which is my favorite method of lecturing. I'm thinking back when I said I was very young when I came to America. One of my first girlfriends in America was an Armenian girl, an American Armenian, and she was born in America. And she used that phrase. She told me she was trying to find out what her faith was, and therefore she went to some classes or something that were being held by an Armenian church in New York. And it struck me at the time that there's a logical contradiction in this statement. Either it is her faith, in which case she doesn't have to find out what it is, or if she has to find out what it is, how could it be her faith? Again, it is a phrase that, a very typically American phrase, that suggests this loose relationship that at least many Americans have, by no means all, but many Americans have, with their religious affiliation. I should tell you, I should have said this in the beginning, I know almost nothing about Mormonism, which is one reason why I accepted this invitation. Curious. I hope by the end of this weekend I will know a little more. And perhaps Mormons are a total exception to what I'm saying, in which case you can listen to this with great interest as things that take place in an exotic realm beyond these mountains, where Presbyterians and Armenians and other Americans live and have all these pluralistic problems. Well, whether this is true in among Mormons in Utah or not, you will have to decide. But for those of us who live in this pluralistic vortex, the effect of all of this can be, I think, described in a very simple way, although I assure you I could also describe it in an extremely complicated way, but it's really not necessary. The major effect of the situation I have just been sketching is that pluralism produces for religion a decline in certainty. Or to put it even more in simpler terms, in this situation, certainty is harder to come by. Why? If you've had excuse me, if you've had even very little sociology or social psychology, the reasons for this result are not difficult to understand at all. Human beings are social creatures. We are made that way. And except perhaps for some of our most direct sense experiences, whatever we know about the world, we can only be certain about because of other people. By sense experiences, I mean something like, okay, my hay fever. I would have a stuffed nose right now, regardless of the social context in which I found myself, and I don't think I would need social confirmation of the fact that I'm physically uncomfortable. Okay, things of that sort, direct bodily experiences, are probably, at least in their basic experience, unattached to social context. But everything else we know, or rather we think we know, we depend upon other people for reassurance and confirmation. I assure you that any one of us in this audience, including myself, if we were suddenly torn out of our social context, put into a totally different context, separated from contact with the people who affirmed our values, our meanings, and our identity in our previous biography, I assure you that in a very short period of time, everything we ever thought we were, or that we knew, or that we believed in, would become questionable. And unfortunately, there are experimental data, not experimental, but empirical data, to prove this. Now, through most of human history, most people lived in situations in which everyone around them, from cradle to grave, shared at least the most important values and beliefs, including religious values and beliefs that they had. And in such situations, it's not difficult to be sure, to have certainty as to one's beliefs. Let me put it graphically. Imagine an old type Catholic village in southern Europe, perhaps Spain. There still are some such villages, even today, where everybody is Catholic, where the church is at the center of life, where, of course, one knows that there are people in the world who are not Catholic. There may even be people who have crossed through that village who were not Catholic. But this is outside. This is exotic. This is not really relevant to one's real life. In such a situation, it's very easy to be a Catholic. In fact, it's almost impossible not to be a Catholic for the aforementioned social and psychological reasons. But take somebody from that village and put him in a big city where there are all kinds of other people, all kinds of other values, beliefs, and religious systems. And in a very short time, this individual is likely, even if he's not, it's not a question of being an intellectual. This is true of very simple and uneducated people. What previously was certain now becomes less certain, perhaps very uncertain indeed. And therefore, the person who previously accepted his religious faith as a fate, as a destiny, in other words, he was Catholic in the same way that he was a Spaniard or a male or 5 feet six tall or whatever other qualities he had that were given to him, he was also a Catholic. Now, to be a Catholic becomes a matter of decision. I want to be a Catholic. I'm going to hold on to the faith of my tradition or something of that sort, which is a very different story. Now, I could go on with this for a very long time. My basic thesis is that many of the problems that religion faces in the contemporary world can be traced to this pluralistic undermining of certitude. I will say something in a moment about why I think, from a religious point of view, this is not as bad or as disturbing as it may at first seem. But let me say something else, which I've become increasingly preoccupied by, and which I have not written about. So those of you who have read some of my books and have spent all this time trying to figure out the joke with which I began and not listening to what I was saying, you might listen now, because this is, you can't look up. While our society has, I think quite successfully, as I said before, solved the problem of religious pluralism, I think we are increasingly facing a fundamental crisis in the society because of moral pluralism. Much of my sociological work in the last, 15 years now, not quite, since about 1968, has dealt with modernization outside the Western world. I've been very much interested in third world countries. And one becomes very much aware in these situations how lucky the United States, American society, has been in one very simple fact, but a fact that's so basic to America that most people are not aware of it, and frankly, I wasn't aware of it until fairly recently, that while there's been enormous religious pluralism in America, the lucky thing has been that most of the, well, all the major religious traditions that were established on the North American continent basically shared the same or very similar moral ideas. In other words, they shared what is not an altogether happy term, but what many people have called a Judeo-Christian ethic, that ethical system that basically derives from the biblical tradition. And while this has been secularized and modified and diversified in various ways, it still remained as a common substratum, a moral substratum for the society. Think by contrast, and I'm again thinking of images and experiences and scenes, think of India, where you have had for centuries now the clash between Hindu and Muslim civilizations, actually splitting the country in half in 1947. totally different, not just religious systems, but moral systems, a very different kind of pluralism. Okay, so far, this Judeo-Christian tradition, despite all this in morality, despite all this diversity in religion, has, I think, served, even in its secularized forms, to provide enough of a consensus in the society to avoid fundamental moral conflict. I think this is changing. And in a way, what is happening is very interesting. It's also very alarming in some fashion, that this substratum, this moral foundation, seems to become shaky. In other words, we can no longer live off the capital of previous generations when it comes to morality. Let me just mention three areas in which this I've become very conscious of this in the last few years. One, which of course is at the center of, well, all three are very much in the center of public attention these days. Perhaps the most central is the abortion issue. I have no intention of telling you what my position is on the abortion issue. That's irrelevant to what I'm saying. I'm simply describing a situation. There is a fundamental clash, and according to public opinion polls, it's close to 50-50 when you take the population as a whole. About 50% basically pro-abortion, about 50% basically anti-abortion. But that's not just some issue of public policy. If you look at this philosophically, it is one of the most basic issues of human life that are being touched upon here, namely, what is a human life? And about half the population feels that the fetus is essentially an appendage to the mother's body, and therefore the removal of that appendage raises no other moral issues except the privacy and the civil rights and so forth of the woman who bears the fetus. There is the other group which feels that the fetus, from the moment of conception, is in fact a human being, and that to kill it is maybe not first-degree murder, but certainly is a homicidal act, and that the fetus is entitled to the protections of law of any other person. Now that's a fundamental, that's not just a disagreement about a particular public issue. It's a fundamental philosophical disagreement on the nature of human life. And it's very hard for me to imagine how the society will be able to function unless some sort of consensus is achieved on this issue. At the moment, it's a little hard for me to imagine the process, the cultural or political process, by which this consensus may be achieved. It raises, of course, all sorts of other issues that are the result of genetic engineering and modern medicine. There's the question of when human life ends, and it touches on a whole series of moral problems. This moral pluralism is going to be much more difficult to handle. We mentioned two others. One is the issue of national defense. I'm sure most of you in this room probably have seen the picture. It was on the first page of many newspapers in this country when President Carter reintroduced registration for the draft. There were these anti-draft demonstrations, and in Princeton University, there was a demonstration, and somebody carried a sign, a student carried a sign that said, "Nothing is worth dying for." Okay, again, let me not take a position here on what I think about the draft. It's a very complex issue, and I don't want to talk about the issue. But if there is within a society a sizable portion of people who feel that this society is not worth defending anymore, if necessary by force of arms, the future of that society in the real world does not look very bright. Again, a fundamental issue, if you like, the issue of patriotism, the issue of national defense, which touches on the moral foundation of any society, not just this one. The third one is, in a way, the air traffic controllers come close to that, but not quite. And that's the issue, what are the limits of social conflict between groups. What I mean is this: in terms of labor disputes, in the United States, and indeed in other Western countries, until very recently it was the assumption that however violent the disagreement may be between the union and its employers, nothing will be done which fundamentally endangers human life. Now, the air controllers is not quite that, because after all, they assumed when they went on strike that everything would stop. But firefighters' strikes, I think, are very interesting in this connection. Nurses' strikes in a number of cities, and in Europe, this has gone much farther, by the way, in Western Europe, than it has in the United States. I think it would have been unthinkable, even 20 years ago, to imagine a city, Montreal, big city on the North American continent, where the firemen went on strike. There were big fires. Pickets prevented volunteer or whoever they were people from stopping the fires, and there were a couple of deaths. In other words, in an ordinary labor dispute, human life was no longer a value to be protected regardless of that dispute. Nurses, I read only the other day in the state where I live, in Massachusetts, there was a nurses' strike in several hospitals, including the intensive care unit. Nurses walked away from patients in intensive care. If they die, they die. This is simply part of the ordinary labor dispute. Okay, again, I would suggest to you that here we are touching on issues of moral pluralism, if you will, which have to be resolved somehow if the society is to continue. Now, I cannot deal with this topic in any more detail. In fact, I think I'm rapidly approaching the end of my allotted time. How much more time do I have? You know? Nobody knows. Well, I don't know. I should talk. Pardon me? Nobody told me how long this thing should go on. Well, I'll go on a little while then. Also, no one has told me, by the way, whether there's any discussion or questions after this, so I will, in authoritarian fashion, decide that there will be. So I will go on for another 15 minutes or so, and then if you have any questions or comments to make, please make them. Now, if I only talk about 15 more minutes, I think I should get back to religion, since that is what you paid to hear. I don't know if you paid, but anyway, you came to hear. Let me leave the moral issue aside. Simply suggest to you that it's a very important issue, and an issue that Americans, and we'll have, it's not just Americans, I think people in other societies also, it's going to be one of the fundamental issues, I think, that our type of society will face in the coming decades, and the future of our society will depend very fundamentally on how we succeed this time in solving the problem of pluralism, but now not in the area of religion, but in the area of morality. The two, of course, are connected, but that's another story. Let me rather go back to what I said a while ago, namely, that while I would insist as a sociologist that indeed religious pluralism undermines religious certainty, that as a Christian I do not find this to be as much of a calamity as it may at first sight appear. Now, in a way, the question here is how you feel about certainty in general. If you find that any questioning of any part of your beliefs is a very serious threat to your own peace of mind or security, then I suppose this will have to be some sort of calamity. But I don't think that at all. And what I find very interesting is that if we look at Western history, there are other examples in other parts of the world, if we look at Western history, the closest that we can find in a period of Western history, the closest to our own kind of religious pluralism, is undoubtedly the late Roman period, the Hellenistic Greco-Roman period. If you read books, plays, philosophers, whatever, say, who wrote in Alexandria in Egypt, that would be a good place to choose. In the, let's say, the 2nd century A.D., you get a feeling of modernity here, and you get it precisely in the area of pluralism. It was a very comparable situation. The old religions coexisting with a mass of new cults and faiths and beliefs, some of them, many of them indeed, coming from the East, others springing up within those very heterogeneous urban agglomerations of the late Roman Empire. Now, I think it is not an accident that it was this time that Christianity came into the world. This was the period of the great Christian missionary enterprise. Paul and the early church fathers and the early church had to face precisely such a situation of religious pluralism, in which to have faith, to be a Christian, to have religious beliefs of any sort, was no longer a matter of fate, but indeed became a decision, an act of choice. I was going to be a Christian, and no longer a worshipper of the gods of Rome, or a Manichaean, or a devotee of Mithras, or whatever I was before my decision to become a Christian. In a very curious way, then, it seems to me, the dynamics of the modern world, dynamics which in many ways are quite different from the dynamics of the late Roman Empire, just mentioned the enormous importance of technology in the modern world. But in a strange way, this dynamics has put us back into a spiritual situation which has an uncanny similarity in my own mind with the situation of the early church. Now, I find it very difficult to regard that as a calamity. It creates peculiar difficulties. It is much easier to be a religious believer in a situation where everything, when it, the matter of religion, is fate or destiny. But I think that if one has some notion, and I do, that truths that one arrives at as a result of an individual search, of individual doubt and questioning and even pain, and then a decision that, yes, this is a truth to which I can hold on to, I believe that this kind of process is more genuine, is more humanly valuable than a process in which one has a religion in the same way in which one has a certain color of eyes or a certain height, or, if you pardon my coming back to this fact, one has Christianity the way one has hay fever by the gene, so to speak. I don't think that is a superior situation. On the contrary, I think our situation has in it, it has difficulties, but it has in it an enormous challenge. It is a challenge to individual believers. It is also a challenge to religious institutions and to religious thought, to the Christian case, to theology. One very interesting thing, and again I'm very conscious of the fact that this may not apply to the situation of many of you in this audience, I can't tell. But I'm so much struck by the fact that in many religious milieus in which I found myself, not only in this country, but elsewhere also, the same thing has happened, that the lines between insiders and outsiders have become blurred. A few years ago, I was in Iran, before the Iranian Revolution, of course, and I met a young man who wrote actually very beautiful poetry based on the tradition of Sufi, of Muslim mystical poetry in Iran. And he had one poem, which of course I can't read Persian, he read it to me in English. It was a very beautiful poem, and I forget now the term. It's an Arabic word that I don't remember now. There's a technical term in Islam of the boundary between that part of the world which is ruled by Islam and the world of unbelievers. It's a boundary of war in Muslim terminology. There's a war between faith and unbelief, and it's the boundary of the Muslim lands. And this young man in his poem said, today that boundary, and he used the Arabic word, runs through the heart of every Muslim. It is no longer an outside boundary. Out there, here are we believers, and out there are the unbelievers. But the boundary between belief and unbelief runs through every individual. And I think this is as much true of Christians or whatever in a pluralistic situation as it is of Muslims. Insiders and outsiders seem to find themselves increasingly in the same situation. One can no longer talk to insiders without at the same time talking to outsiders. They're eavesdropping. It's very difficult to be among ourselves in any religious context unless it sort of goes underground into some sort of sectarian underworld. There are always these others who also listen and talk and have their own point of view. Now, I think this is only debilitating if one associates religion with unwavering certitude about every aspect of one's own religious tradition. If one does not make that assumption, then I think we face an immensely challenging situation. Namely, people with religious concerns all over the world engaged in a common quest for truth. Now, I have, according to my own self-imposed limit, 7 minutes left, and use these 7 minutes to talk about something that I think is very important in this situation, and that is the new possibility of dialogue between the great world religions, and especially between the great religions of the West and the religions that have most of them, in one way or another, come out of the subcontinent of India. It means especially Hinduism and Buddhism. These traditions have met before. It's by no means unique to our own age. They met for centuries in Central Asia. In fact, we have now, last summer I was at a symposium on Buddhism, and I listened to a German scholar talk about new archaeological discoveries in Central Asia, which show that for centuries a very intensive dialogue was going on between Christianity and Buddhism. So this is not altogether new. But because of factors which are not at all mysterious again, which have to do with the way the world has become a smaller place, I suppose, another cliche phrase, but intercommunication between cultures has become very common. People move around with much greater ease. People are aware of each other in a different way. And of course, there are these massive migrations of human beings, millions of them, across the surface of the earth. And as a result of all this, the other great world religions, which for most of the history of the West have been out there somewhere, perhaps of interest to missionaries or colonial administrators or perhaps scholars, but for most people basically irrelevant, and certainly for most religious thinkers in the Christian world irrelevant, these other traditions have suddenly come much closer. I'm always struck by the fact that and I'm sure sight unseen, this would be true of the University of Utah, that in any decent university bookstore in this country, and the same is true in Western Europe, you could go and for $100, you can buy in paperback, in good English translation, most of the great works of the major world religions and commentaries and secondary literature. It's available to us in a way which it has not been before. And again, in most urban centers, in most academic centers of the Western world, not only can you easily get books about Tibetan Buddhism or Taoism or whatever, but you will find people who in their own lives live and express these faiths. There are a number of scenarios we can imagine as to the future of American society and the Western world where this would not happen. That is, where there would not be more contact between us and these other great world religions. Obviously not in the case of a world war. Obviously not if international tensions become so great that increasingly nations shield themselves off from each other, or if there is massive economic disaster in the world. There are a number of possible scenarios where this would not happen. But if one wants to be a little bit more optimistic about the future of the world, and I think one has reason to be at least mildly optimistic that we are not heading for a total catastrophe, then I think it is inevitable that this communication between religious traditions will increase and become, I think, much more serious. My thesis is that at least for Christian theology in the coming decades, it is this challenge from the East which is likely to produce some of the most interesting reflection. And again, I think for a very basic reason. This is true of individuals and it's true of traditions. One always discovers one's own by coming in touch with the other. It is impossible to be a man without women. It is impossible to be conscious of oneself as an American unless one is conscious of non-Americans. Okay, this is also true, because it's not a hostile consciousness I'm talking about, but one sees the other and recognizes that there is an other, then one thinks, what is it that I am? I'm a man, I'm an American, I'm whatever, I'm a Christian. I think this is also true in religion. And if you look at the great history of Christianity, also of Christian thought, it was always in the encounter and contestation with others that Christian thought developed. Because the first other was the Greco-Roman world. That little Jewish sect came out of Palestine, confronted the massive and overwhelming power of the Hellenistic world, and came to terms with it. That was the birth of Christian theology. Then that world hit it a second time in a very roundabout way in the High Middle Ages, through the Arabs, through Islam, when Aristotle came to Europe. Scholasticism developed. Again, the other, in this case, the Aristotle brought to the West by Muslim scholars and Jewish scholars, became the other. And in contestation with that other, Christian thought made another enormous jump. For the last few centuries, the major other for Christian thought has been modernity. It has been especially modern secularism. Most theological passion had to do with how to come to terms with modernity. It is my hunch, my hypothesis, if you will. I can't be completely certain of this, but it's my hunch that this particular dialogue has exhausted itself. Modernity itself is in crisis. In fact, I've alluded to some of the reasons why it is in crisis. I don't think it has an enormous amount of challenge left to give to Christian thought, to religious thought in general. And the 567th attempt to make a Christian interpretation of Marx or Freud, I think, is not going to be any more interesting than the previous 566. I think the real challenge, the real other, is coming from a very different direction. And I think it is particularly from Asia that it is likely to come. What the outcome of that will be is very hard to predict, just as it was very hard to predict what the outcome of previous confrontations of this sort were going to be, was going to be. I'm only sure of two things. One is that truth reasserts itself regardless of historical or social conditions. And I think the truth, which is at the core of the Christian religious tradition, has nothing to fear from any such encounter. It will prevail, it will reassert itself. At the same time, I am very much convinced that no tradition and no individual can remain the same having gone through this kind of confrontation. It is not possible to seriously entertain the idea that some of the key ideas of Hinduism and Buddhism might contain truth, and then to go on thinking as a Christian the way one did before one entertained these ideas. That is impossible. I think the situation, as I said before, is very exciting. It is a great challenge. But I'll stop here. I don't have to have it.
Yeah. I'll be glad to see them if you want.
I could do it myself. Well, if you want to say something or ask me something.
Did everybody hear the question?
Well, the question was, could I explain without, was underlined speaking for another hour, in what way one would not be the same if one once encountered these visions. Let me tell you a story. I was in India 3 years ago. It was my first time and so far my only time. And it was a very curious experience for me. I won't go into all the details. It was a very important experience for me. Well, in the course of my stay there, I saw a number of funerals. But the first funeral I saw was in Calcutta. And it was a Hindu funeral. The body is carried, there's no coffin. The dead body is carried on a wooden platform and taken out to be burnt. And I was going to see somebody, actually a Christian scholar there who was interested in dialogue with Hinduism, and I came on this funeral and I walked with them for a couple blocks. They were chanting, and then I had to go to my appointment. And I mentioned this. It was kind of, it's a stark sight. I mean, one is not accustomed in the West to see dead bodies being carried around the street, so it was a kind of shock. And I was talking to this man about it. He said, were they chanting? I said, yes, and he said, that means it's a Brahman funeral, I know that. So I said, what were they chanting? And he said, well, he doesn't know what they were chanting, but at Hindu funerals, they always chant, I think it's the seventh chapter of the Gita, Bhagavad Gita. And he started reciting it to me, first in English and then in Sanskrit, first in Sanskrit and in English. Well, when I went home to my hotel, in better hotels in India, they not only have a Gideon's Bible, but they have a Gideon's Gita. So there was, it isn't Gideon. So I was, here I noticed at the Hilton, they have the Gideon's Bible and the Gideon's Book of Mormon. So I was alone in my hotel room and I read this chapter in the Gita. I think it's the seventh, I'm not sure. And I'd read it before, in fact, many times, but I had not known before that it was chanted at funerals. I'm not evading your question, I'm getting to your question. It's a very beautiful passage. It's a hymn to the eternal self. And it goes something like this. The true self, which passes from one migration to another. It says when a person is tired of old clothes, he throws them away. Just so the true self, when it is tired of a body, it throws that body away. Itself, the true self, it can never be destroyed. There's a very beautiful passage. Fire cannot burn it, wind cannot wither it, water cannot wet it. It is immutable, eternal, unchangeable. And then, This remembers chanted at a funeral. And then the final line of that passage is, therefore, knowing this, do not sorrow. Right? Now, I was reading this in my hotel room, and I had an enormous sense of rebellion. And I had the thought that even if I believe that whole metaphysics, which is basically metaphysics of reincarnation, I would not be consoled if I were following a corpse of someone I love to the funeral pyre. Then I asked myself, why would I not be consoled? And then I remembered a Greek word from the New Testament, the word ephapax, which means once and for all. Now, in the New Testament, when I was back home, I looked it up in my concordance, it always refers to Jesus, the once and for all atonement, especially the letter of the Hebrews. But I wasn't thinking of Jesus at all. I was thinking of once and for all in a different sense, the basic Western experience that it is this world, this body, this life, which is of decisive importance, and you cannot throw it away as if it were an old bit of clothes and go on to something else. Now, there is a basic clash here, not just of beliefs, but of a sense of reality. Now, there's an easy way out of this, and that is to say the other is a lot of nonsense. Okay? Westerners have done this with India for centuries, and they do it the other way around. I mean, the educated Hindu will say, well, you know, Westerners are like children, they don't understand, and you know, that's the easy way out. I don't think we can do that. And we have to somehow find a way of understanding the world in which both of these traditions are seen to have access to truth. That will change us. And if one, in however modified a form, is willing to accept the possibility that this whole Hindu business of the stream of lives has reality to it, maybe not quite the way Hinduism has put it, but some reality, we will live in a different world. Now that's one example one could give others. Well, on this, you know, there's a difference between some sociological theorists. There are some sociological theorists who believe that modern society is simply a contractual arrangement, and that a modern society with all its technological sophistication requires no more moral consensus than does a utilities company, let's say, and its customers. I don't believe that. I'm much more in a classical sociological tradition. Emile Durkheim was, I guess, the most famous spokesman of it, that any human society must at least have some fundamental moral consensus. Therefore, no, you didn't quite understand me. I do not think that we will succeed in having a moral pluralism like the religious pluralism we've had. I think we will have to make some societal decisions as to who is right and who is wrong on some of these issues. Now, what I have difficulty seeing is how we're going to do that. But it cannot be a process of simply political negotiation. You cannot negotiate over fundamental issues as to what human existence is. You have to somehow arrive at a new consensus, which will have to be something much more basic, I suspect religious, than a political bargaining process. Unless we do that, I think we're going to have very serious problems. No, I didn't mean to minimize this. I'm well aware of this history. When I said we've handled it successfully, I meant at this, if you look at the whole history and where we are now, I think we can say the society has been successful. But I don't think we can follow the same formula. I mean, that we have followed with religious pluralism. I mean, just think of the issues I have mentioned. You can have, any American city, even a small American, relatively small American city, look at the religious advertisement section of the newspaper on Saturdays. They got all these churches side by side, and synagogues and temples and whatever. And some people go here, some people go there. And they, I don't think you could have that with the question of, well, take the abortion issue. So some of us think this way, some of us think that way. Well, then what? It cannot be solved in the same way. There has to be some sort of agreement. And the same, I think, is true of other basic moral issues that now divide us. Well, you know, there's been a whole literature on this, and some of it is interesting, some of it is not terribly interesting. I think I think you define a sect as a sort of subgroup within a society which tries to shelter itself off from the rest of society in order to keep its certainty going. And I'm sure this does not very well describe Mormonism, certainly in recent history. I don't think. Well, I think it's much too big. Sectarian. But you have to decide that. I cannot speak to that. But I think the much more interesting issue is in terms of this terminology, is one that Richard Niebuhr introduced in his book on American denominationalism, and that is the concept of denomination. And what Niebuhr called a denomination was a church that was willing to accept that it was not the only one. And that's a very important step in the history of pluralism, where churches have previously been forced by circumstances to accept others. When the Catholics and the Protestants in the 30 Years' War failed to exterminate each other in the German-speaking countries of Europe, although they tried very hard on both sides, they had to accept the fact that this other thing was going to be there, however awful it was to them. And now that's not becoming a denomination, okay? On both sides, there was still the notion that the other was an utter horror, okay, which one had to live with because of the imperfections of the world. A denomination is something else. A denomination is when a church, although, of course, it still thinks it has some particular angle on the world which is better than others, but the others also have a right to be there. And that is the decisive step, it seems to me, into the pluralistic situation. And I cannot judge how that refers to Mormonism at this stage. Thank you.
Applause expresses better than any words our deep appreciation, Dr. Berger, for your presentation. I think you were the only one who remained conscious throughout your speaking of your hay fever. The rest of us forgot all about it as we were stimulated and received such a delightful touch as you provoked our minds and inspired our spirits. Thank you again.